It's Thursday, February 4th. There's votes about what you support, and there's votes about what you believe in. We start here. In a late-night meeting, Republicans gather to decide whether anything crosses the line.
She's probably the most powerful person in the Trump wing of the Republican House.
They wouldn't penalize conspiracy theories in private, so what will happen today in public? We know vaccines prevent symptoms, but can they keep you from spreading COVID too?
The more it mutates, the more it has a chance of evading the vaccine.
The new data and why it's a more urgent race than you think. And when the next caravan arrives, what will they see?
All or nothing, and we usually end up with nothing.
How quickly are immigration policies changing under the Biden administration? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. There's a difference between being divisive and being dangerous.
As President Trump says, we are at a war right now against an invisible enemy.
When Marjorie Taylor Greene was elected to Congress last year, voters knew she was divisive, outspoken. In addition to running a construction company and a CrossFit gym, the Georgia native spent a lot of her time making videos with far-right political statements.
Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the fake news media truly are the enemy of the American people.
But at times, she also appeared to go further, partaking in conspiracy theories, including the made-up set of beliefs known as QAnon.
Q is a patriot. He is someone that is very much loves his country, and he's on the same page as us, and he is very pro-Trump, okay?
She later distanced herself from QAnon, but to the chagrin of her colleagues, kept alleging the election had been stolen.
We've got to stop this attack, stop our Senate seats from being handed over to these radicals, and we're going to fight for President Trump on January 6th.
Well, on January 6th, with people storming the Capitol, some of them claiming they were just carrying out the will of a secret official named Q, many in Congress said this stuff wasn't just divisive. This was dangerous.
I do believe, and I have said this all along, that we will probably need a supplemental for more security for members when the enemy is within the House of Representatives.
Well, over the last week, more evidence has emerged showing exactly what Marjorie Taylor Greene was willing to post before she was elected.
She appeared to endorse violent threats against House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats.
It's a crime punishable by death is what treason is. Nancy Pelosi is guilty of treason.
She has even speculated a plane never flew into the Pentagon on 9/11.
It's odd. There's never any evidence shown for a plane in the Pentagon.
Even her reactions to other posts are telling. At one point, when a Facebook user claimed the mass shooting at a Parkland, Florida high school was a false flag planned shooting, Greene responds, exactly. In a post seen by CNN before it was deleted, someone suggests putting a bullet in Nancy Pelosi's head. Well, underneath that is a little blue thumbs up from Greene. She later said she wasn't the only one operating her social media accounts. Now, as a result, Democrats and many Republicans have called on House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to kick her off her committees.
Kevin McCarthy should handle this problem because Marjorie Taylor Greene is totally out of control.
After all, Republicans can decide who among them sits where. McCarthy said he would talk to her in private. Well, that meeting happened, but if it was meant to convince Greene to resign or publicly apologize, well, then it didn't go well.
The leader of the Republican Party in the House condemned Congresswoman Greene's comments, but also called Democrats' effort to remove her from committees a power grab.
Democrats, though, who control the House and can pass things with a simple majority, now say if the GOP won't act, they will. So last night, Republican House members got together in a private meeting to discuss what is acceptable for a House Republican to say and what's not.
Republicans, we have learned, have decided late today, and this is all moving, but so far, to allow her to keep her posts.
Sources told us Marjorie Taylor Greene expressed some contrition for her remarks and was applauded. In fact, half the caucus, we're told, gave her a standing ovation. The person who might have found themselves facing even more political peril was the number three Republican in the room, Liz Cheney. The offensive thing she had done was to say President Trump should be punished for his role in the insurrection. In fact, in the same meeting, dozens of Republicans voted to kick her out of her position. She survived, but it left Republicans wondering, what is the bigger sin in our party right now? Spreading misinformation or criticizing colleagues who do? This is a big 24-hour period for the Republican Party. Let's go to Reed Galen. He's a co-founder of the Lincoln Project. That's a group of current and former Republicans who actively campaigned against President Trump this fall. Reed, if Marjorie Taylor Greene's committee assignments come up for a vote today, what's going to happen?
I would venture to say that the Democrats will throw her off, and that most Republicans, if, you know, with the exception of maybe the 10 or 20 who don't want anything to do with Marjorie Taylor Greene, will vote to, keep her on that committee. We should not be surprised. It is, I think, a perfect analog that a freshman congressperson from a rural district in Northwest Georgia now is the de facto conference chair of the Republican minority in Congress.
Wait, why do you say that she's the conference chair? She's just like a low-level person on these committees.
Because, I should say this, not conference chair. She's the minority leader because she is able to force these actions, and Kevin McCarthy is unable or unwilling to do anything about it.
In a statement, Republican leader Kevin McCarthy saying he had spoken to Green and she recognized that her past comments now have greater meaning.
When he gets scared, he runs to Mar-a-Lago.
We saw House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy meeting with President Trump yesterday in Florida. It was just 2 weeks ago that Kevin McCarthy said that the president bears responsibility for the attack. But now
when McCarthy had a finance call with the NRCC members, Republican members of Congress last week, looking for $1 million, Marjorie Taylor Greene popped in for $175,000. As far as I'm concerned, she's probably the most powerful person in the Trump wing of the Republican House.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, I love Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Is that essentially because she's got voters who we know are important to the GOP at this point, right? Like, I was going to say, is there an argument to make here? Hey, Congress doesn't decide who's in Congress. Voters decide who's in Congress, and voters in her district knew what she was about before she showed up.
Sure. Look, I mean, members of the, constituents in the Georgia's 14th congressional district can elect whomever they want to Congress.
Hello, Northwest Georgia.
Other members of Congress, however, do not have to put up with that member's bad behavior, antics, willingness to go along with sedition and insurrection. They don't have to do any of those things.
Is the objection in writing and signed by a member and a senator?
The objection is writing, not signed by a senator.
In that case, the objection cannot be entertained.
I think that for the 130-some that voted to, object to electoral votes on January 6th, they might just be too far gone, that they've decided that they're Trumpers and that's who they're going to be. And that's the majority of the conference. For others, I think they're, firmly in the I ignore it and it'll go away caucus, which, as you know, rarely works out. And I think also too many of them think too much about what goes on in their districts, which is most of these folks are probably not in districts where, they will be primaried because they're so gerrymandered to begin with. And if they are, remember that they took an oath to the Constitution. This is not like running for school president. Like, if you didn't want to be a member of Congress and stand up for the things you need to stand up for, then don't be there.
But that's what I'm trying to get at here, Reed, because clearly there's this huge group of voters who hear Marjorie Taylor Greene speak and they say, hey, that is someone who, like, when I hear her, I hear the truth. She sees the world like I do. Is that suddenly a worldview that only began with President Trump? Like, you worked on the McCain campaign, mm-hmm. right? You worked on the George W. Bush campaign.
Right.
The Tea Party was right around the corner.
Sure.
It was being cheered on by Republican lawmakers and like this media landscape that was pushing a very specific worldview. So I guess I'm wondering is the Republican Party just, coming to grips with voters that it's been cultivating over the years?
Well, it's a good question. I think that 2009, 2010 is probably a starting point.
The best example is the claim made not just by radio and cable talk show hosts, but by prominent politicians, that we plan to set up panels of bureaucrats with the power to kill off senior citizens.
You could even go back to Palin a little bit, I think.
It is a lie, plain and simple.
He's not lying in that those two words will not be found in any of those thousands of pages of different variations of the health care bill. No, death panel isn't there. But he's incorrect.
But what I think you saw was that the populist wing of the party was growing.
The people of Texas have elected a new senator.
There's a Tea Party tidal wave, and we're sending a message to them.
And the establishment part of the party was both unable and unwilling to do things politically to understand and bring those people back into the fold.
There's a new party in town, and we're forced to be reckoned with.
President Trump won by a landslide. He's not being given what he's worked for, what we've all voted for.
But I think it's a broader issue of demonizing governance, frankly, which is a lot of Republicans now, Trump being prime among them, even though he's not in government anymore, see government as something to attack and dismantle.
And we got to get rid of the weak Congress people, the ones that aren't any good, the Liz Cheney's of the world. We got to get rid of them.
Or if you're a guy like Steve Bannon, who considered himself a Leninist, to burn to the ground. They're nihilists. There is no ideology around which they revolve, with the exception of attaining power.
This is my first time in Wyoming. I've been here for about an hour, and I feel like I already know the place a lot better than your misguided representative, Liz Cheney.
And so I think that's where you see it. There is no conservative viewpoint of governance anymore. It is purely performative and deconstructive.
Hey, last question, because I wanted to ask you. You're a co-founder of the Lincoln Project, right? Mm-hmm. You're an alumnus of the McCain campaign. Mm-hmm. So is John Weaver, right? Who's been accused now of sexually harassing more than 20 men in his past. You guys ran a whole campaign this past fall about, like, this return to decency, this return to norms. Trump supporters have long said, like, there are no norms, there is no decency. People just hide it better than Trump ever did. Did your co-founder make their case for them here?
You know what? I would like to say this is that, you know, what I mean, I can't defend and will not defend his behavior. I don't think that one person in our organization who hasn't frankly been with us for more than 6 months, maybe seven, should be a blot on the organization's mission or reputation. But I would say this, it does not surprise me at all that that's where the Trump folks are headed.
As in, you're saying Trump folks are headed that way in terms of how they'll interpret those accusations.
Correct.
All right. And we should mention, of the men who have spoken out, none have accused Weaver of unlawful behavior. Weaver, for his part, has said he was disheartened and sad that I may have brought discomfort to anyone in what I thought at the time were mutually consensual discussions. Reed Galen from the Lincoln Project, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Next up on Start Here, if we don't get everyone vaccinated soon, your vaccine might not matter as much. Back after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
I need you to brace yourself for something shocking. I'm about to give you some honest-to-God good news about COVID-19 this morning. Yesterday, the CDC reported that more than 27 million Americans have gotten at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. That there is more than the number of Americans that have gotten COVID to date. In addition to that, the daily death toll is slowly but surely falling for now.
We're still in a reasonably good zone in the sense of getting some protection that you can extrapolate.
That's your good news there, which means, of course, now I'm going to remind you that 26 million COVID cases is a huge number, and we will likely see the American death toll pass 500,000 later this month. But wait, there is one other piece of good news. So far, there are two vaccines on the market, Pfizer and Moderna. You've heard of them. A third could be coming, Johnson & Johnson. Well, yesterday, scientists behind a fourth vaccine began telling us more about it. This is a joint effort from AstraZeneca and Oxford. We got ABC's Ann Flaherty here to help us break it down. And by the way, I feel like I've been hearing about this AstraZeneca vaccine forever. What is taking so long in getting it here?
Right. So this is the vaccine that's getting hyped up overseas. There's a lot of interest in it. In the U.S., regulators say they want to wait until they see the results from a clinical trial here, 30,000 participants, to see if it actually really works. But there was some interesting news, as you say, that came out of this. The Oxford researchers said that they have found that was interesting is that there's evidence it could reduce transmission.
The study also suggesting that the vaccine can reduce the spread of COVID by as much as 67% after one dose, suggesting those vaccinated are unlikely to infect others.
Now that is really good news. It's very positive because we know that vaccines are the way out of this.
Fewer people were found to be carrying the virus after they received this vaccine dose. That's a big deal because to date, we don't actually know if the vaccines stop you from transmitting the virus. And transmitting is the virus is, what gets other people sick.
But wait, so, okay, like reducing transmission, that's great. Keeping people from getting severely sick, that's great. But then I'm looking at the transmission numbers and they're like, oh, it might reduce it by up to like 50%. Is that enough?
Well, we don't know if it's enough, but what it does give hope for is that if you stop transmitting the virus, or at least if you have less of a chance of transmitting the virus, that the virus stops mutating. And that's been one of these top concerns that U.S. health officials have right now. The more a virus mutates, the more it learns how to evade the human body's immune system. So it's essentially getting smarter, and it learns how to survive.
Mutants are here in the United States. They are not dominant yet. We can prevent them from becoming dominant by trying to suppress the replication.
But what U.S. scientists want to do is to stop the virus from transmitting, because the more that it transmits, the more it has a chance of mutating. The more it mutates, the more it has a chance of evading the vaccine. That is a big problem in the United States. And right now, the vaccine rollout is going so slow, there are concerns that the virus will be mutating overseas, particularly in countries where the virus is rampant, and that those fresh mutations will come back to the United States through international travelers.
Oh, okay. And that is really important, I feel, because I've been thinking, like, the answer to this here is, like, get all the Americans vaccinated, right? Get everyone vaccinated, get the doses wherever we can, just get everyone vaccinated. You're saying we could get every American vaccinated, and that still might not be enough in some way.
Well, I mean, it's the worst case scenario, Brad, but I do think that there are a lot of public health experts who are saying, you know, if this virus mutates overseas and comes back into the United States, there is a chance that people who've already been infected with this virus or have gotten the vaccine, that they could be reinfected with these more deadly viruses. Now, we're not seeing that right now. You know, I want to be clear about that.
Right.
We are seeing evidence that it's chipping away at the efficacy of these vaccines, but it would still work. They're still pretty high numbers. So, I mean, there's a lot of hope.
With these vaccines, with these case rates declining, we see light at the end of the tunnel.
But U.S. officials are taking this really seriously, and they say that this is absolutely a race.
All right. We got the good news and Flaherty there. Not bad news. Realism. And Flaherty with the realism. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
We saw an interesting reversal in Washington yesterday.
The Justice Department is accusing Yale University of discriminating against student applicants. A two-year investigation found Yale rejected Asian American and white applicants based on their race.
A while back, the Department of Justice filed suit against Yale University, saying that by creating more favorable conditions for black and brown students, they were actually discriminating against white and Asian students. Racial justice advocates said, you're really just trying to bring back advantages for the white kids. Well, yesterday, the DOJ dropped the case. Remember, the DOJ, just like every federal department, has a new boss at the top of the food chain. And I bring this up because even in huge federal departments where policies are built up over years, politics can change everything overnight. We're also seeing that in real time at the Department of Homeland Security.
I, Alejandro Mayorkas,
do solemnly swear, that I will support and defend, the Constitution of the United States.
Earlier this week, the new head of the DHS was sworn in. Alejandro Mayorkas became the first immigrant and the first Latino to lead the agency that's in charge of immigration. So, what changes have we already seen, and which changes are still on the way? ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer is with us. And Devin, even before Mayorkas was sworn in, President Biden made it clear immigration policy is changing.
Yeah, Brad, I mean, no issue arguably has seen a bigger sea change in this town and across the country than immigration. I mean, on day one, Joe Biden ended the travel ban on predominantly Muslim countries. He froze the construction of Donald Trump's border wall. He ordered a moratorium on all deportations, sweeping moves that really reversed some of the cornerstone of Donald Trump's hardline approach to immigration. And then this week, we saw him sign three more orders.
President Biden reversed executive orders. This is another big subject where he's looking at on immigration that his predecessor, President Trump, put into place 4 years ago.
Reversing some of these Trump policies and shifting to what the administration is calling a much more humane approach to migration. They've created this task force aimed at reuniting children who were separated from their parents at the border under Trump's zero tolerance policy. They're reviewing that Remain in Mexico mandate for asylum seekers keeping themselves at the border, and they're reviewing policies throughout Homeland Security and the State Department, the public charge rule, the naturalization test of all things, to really try to humanize this process.
Trying hard, it's not enough. You know, we have been out there saying all or nothing, and we usually end up with nothing.
But all of it's remarkably measured, Brad. I mean, as much as some of these things are sweeping, a lot of advocates are saying some of these steps are simply reviews. They're not immediate reversals. And fact of the matter is that a lot of the Trump policies, the controversial ones, including fast-track removal at the border, still remain in place for now.
I was going to say, like, Biden's taking us back to 2016, except maybe not even that far. Like, if they're just reviewing whether they want to go back to the 2016 rules.
Yeah, I mean, the president has to be careful on a couple of counts, right? I mean, federal law, as you and I have talked about over the years, makes it illegal to arbitrarily change regulations without proper notice and public reasoning. That tripped up Donald Trump a couple times.
I'm not making new law. I'm eliminating bad policy. What I'm doing is taking on the issues that 99% of them that the president, the last president of the United States, issued executive orders I thought were very counterproductive to our security, counterproductive to who we are as a country.
So Joe Biden has to be careful here not to create those same mistakes, but he's also facing a border situation right now that is in some ways deteriorating.
The reason why this is happening right now is because of the perception that our borders are going to be open under the Biden administration.
Brad, and some of the veterans from the Trump administration border enforcement agencies tell me things could get uncomfortable for Joe Biden really quick. Remember those desperate economic, health, security conditions in Central America? They haven't gone away now that Joe Biden is president, and in many ways only gotten worse with the pandemic.
100 migrants defiantly approach the U.S. border seeking asylum, hoping this is the end of a grueling month-long journey from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala through Mexico.
And we're starting to see this resurgence of migrants coming back to the border. The numbers plunged over the past couple of years. Things got under control, but they're slowly starting to tick back up. Some of that, I'm told, is because of this promise that Joe Biden, in his softer approach on some of these matters, might be favorable to undocumented immigrants crossing the border.
Joe Biden, through his legislation, wants to give amnesty to 15 million illegal immigrants.
But in any case, border officials are already bracing for a mass surge of people coming, including unaccompanied children. Remember, Donald Trump had that huge crisis of kids in cages.
We're going to work to undo the moral and national shame of the previous administration that literally, not figuratively, ripped children from the arms of their families, their mothers and fathers at the border.
And what to do with those kids? Well, already the Department of Health and Human Services, which is responsible for caring for these kids, is already setting up tent camps and expanding their facilities. They're getting ready for a surge that they're expecting in the next couple of months. So Joe Biden, Alejandro Mayorkas, his entire administration going to have to tread very carefully on this immigration issue.
Well, so Devin, that makes me wonder, like, what happens when the next caravan of migrants doesn't in fact arrive at the southern border? Like, this time would they be invited over the bridge? Because that's not even what we necessarily saw during the Obama years. And by the way, the Senate is even tighter. So, like, what could you do besides executive orders?
Yeah, the legacy of the Obama years looms large here. I mean, Obama campaigned, like Joe Biden, on immigration reform, a pathway to citizenship. And of course, he has failed to achieve a deal in Congress. Meanwhile, his administration, the Biden-Obama administration, deported a record number of migrants over 8 years. So President Obama was hammered for that. Joe Biden has sort of sought to distance himself from that legacy, and he recognizes the difficulty and the disappointment.
We need to show our community that we are moving forward, that it's not going to be like what happened in 2013.
That's why we saw on day one, he unveiled this sweeping proposal for immigration reform in Congress. It's a bill, the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021. It would be the biggest overhaul in 35 years in this country, an eight-year pathway to citizenship, more border security, more legal immigration. But it's going to be a tough sell, Brad. And with all the other priorities going on right now, it's hard to see that it gains traction quickly, but Joe Biden is under immense pressure to deliver some progress on legalization. Maybe if it's just a DACA compromise, farm workers, TPS holders, but that's where I'd be watching in the next couple of months.
Right. One other executive order from the Biden administration, not just immigrants who are like getting visas and things. You also have refugees, which had gone down to 15,000 a year under the Trump administration. The Biden administration says they'll be taking six figures worth of refugees per year starting right now. All right. Devin Dwyer, thank you.
Thank you.
And one last thing. Everyone was excited for a good old-fashioned tennis tournament. Well, yesterday in Australia, a hotel worker came down with a case of COVID-19.
The Australian Open, well, it's hanging in the balance because up to 600 players and officials, they've all been sent back into isolation whilst they wait to get that test back.
But this isn't just a tennis emergency. It's being treated like a national emergency. Because before this, for two straight weeks, there was no one on the entire continent with a locally transmitted case of COVID-19. It had just been eliminated from public life. In fact, it was this complete victory over the virus that gave officials the confidence to say, we're going to hold the Australian Open tennis tournament with thousands of fans. Welcome back to the good old days. Well, flash forward to now.
Victorian authorities have hastily reintroduced coronavirus restrictions. Masks are now mandatory inside. The cap on gatherings has been reduced to 15 in a household.
So over the next several days, an entire nation will hold its breath and wait for more tests to see if the tennis tournament they love has reignited a crisis. Watching a different world, this place where just COVID did not exist for the last month. Hey, thank you to those who have been giving us those 5-star ratings and reviews. They really help us out. Also, they just cancel out the person that's like, oh, the commercial was too loud, 1-star. Really? Like, how quickly you turn. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.